sensible voices. I think it's very interesting that Jesus' main problem with the Pharisees, their for-show lives, expressed in the word hypocrite, has been utterly subverted today. Now that is a bit too handy, convenient, not to be able to plainly hear what Jesus was saying about the people who consistently drew his ire and approbation. Nowadays, we use the word hypocrite to mean that people are inconsistent in maintaining their pious lifestyle, not strict enough. Talking a strict game, but not doing it for real. What they're preaching is stricter than what they're actually living. Like one should be a more hardcore Pharisee if one is to avoid being called a hypocrite by Jesus. That's totally backwards. I think it's clear that whether Pharisees followed their own rules or not, Jesus' problem with them wasn't really about whether they followed those rules. It was that they weren't living authentic lives. We're giving the appearance of following rules that were all about giving a certain impression. They were performers under masks. It wasn't like if some of the Pharisees were doing exactly what they said and were following all of the rules, getting all of their lines right, playing their best side to the audience and hitting their marks perfectly, that Jesus wouldn't have thought of those Pharisees as actor hypocrites. That wouldn't fix his problem with them at all. Good actors are still actors. It was the for-show life that earned them the names and insults. Playing to an audience, wanting to be noticed and known as a religious person with exemplary self-control, the control required to follow all those rules. Back to control again. We grew up under it, and grew up trying to wield ever greater amounts of it over ourselves and others, thinking far more control was possible and useful than it ever really was. Louisa writes,
I am a full-blown, able-bodied, proud, deceptive micromanager, driven by fear of chaos. Control is sin, not the loss of it.
Anne says,
Control an issue? I am a bit of a control freak. Need obsessive. It is tied to feeling overwhelmed a lot. I don't think this is religion-related. Yes, a need for control has limited my options. I do try to push outside of my comfort zone in order to have experiences that I'm scared of. It's primarily parties and group social events that I would tend to avoid, but I have done it a lot, and I can keep pushing against that discomfort. Regarding wanting to control others, I'd like to think I've learned to accept difference, but who knows? I can appreciate people from a distance, but I like to maintain my personal freedom and control over my immediate surroundings and my time.
Jake argues that some control is necessary, but it's always tempting to wield more than you need. He says,
Control is important to me in certain situations, where I feel I have responsibility. Looking after kids or teaching someone, I struggle with the need to control too much. But I think a loss of control is often when God moves the most powerfully. A loss of control, I've seen, can also be the fastest way to unravel a situation and watch it burn, though. I'm speaking of two different types of control here. Trying to control what God communicates or does in a situation is a bad idea. Trying to control the kids you're babysitting for their own good is a good thing. The Messiah bore the weight that we don't have to, and works and lives through us today. He's the one that does the work. But at the same time, how could you believe that not controlling those you have responsibility for at all would be a good idea? Pastors don't allow people to practice blood seances on Sunday mornings for a reason.
Growing up, we always knew that some Christians were what we called more legal than the rest of us. We didn't know the word legalism or legalistic. Marijuana is legal in Colorado. My family, however, was legalistic. But to us, legal was something other Christians called us when we weren't around. And we felt that ideally we should, but didn't really want to, live more like the most legalistic people willing to be gathered with us. Some people left us and joined up with even more legalistic brethren groups when we didn't crack down on TVs and sleeveless dresses enough. And we kind of assumed that God wished we were more like those guys. That it would have been a better testimony to the world, that it would have made God bless us more. Never mind how passive-aggressive, quietly superior, judgmental of us, and protecting of their own reputations those people seemed to be. Never mind all the scandals that came to light eventually. Never mind the clear correlation between legalism and mental illness. Never mind the clear connection between child molestation among us and the perpetrators of the abuse consistently being the biggest legalists we had to offer. But no one ever said in any sermon I ever sat under that
the key problem with the Pharisees was legalism. That's what Jesus meant by hypocrites, actors under masks living fake performance lives according to image-conscious law.
legalism will keep you from Jesus, and your legalism will keep other people from wanting to talk about Jesus with you. Because if you're host to a legalistic spirit, not only do you not know Jesus as you claim to, you would be getting one of his patented Pharisee lectures if he were here today. Legalism is something people do instead of knowing Jesus. You cannot seek to put people under law and follow a path of genuinely loving them at the same time. It's how you create a mechanized human system for fabricating the outer appearance of being a Christian and acting in love instead of genuinely knowing and connecting to Jesus and those people. You can't follow Jesus or serve his interests or help out his people while following legalistic motives and methods. It's a whole different thing, an alternative, a substitute. Love will never lead you to legalism. Legalism will never lead you to love. There is a great gulf yawning between the two. They are heading in opposite directions, directly away from each other. So I'm saying that right now, with an echo effect. In fact, the gospel message seems to be utterly at odds with the Pharisee message of placing one's hope for daily life in using careful self-control to follow obsessively devised rules to keep ourselves from doing bad things through our own fleshly willpower. Christianity just isn't about that. And that tired old religion doesn't work, doesn't give us more open, loving, forgiving hearts. The root problem involves not only our doing bad things, but also our not doing good things. More troublingly still, at root, it's not just about us doing bad things, but about us being bad things. It's not just that we won't do enough good things, it's that we aren't enough good things. God doesn't just want us to follow rules. He wants us to be creatures who naturally do, enjoy, help, and draw out good, who do not do any of those good things for reasons that aren't good too. He wants this to occur naturally. Exactly like a cat does not wake up and say to himself, "Now I must remember to diligently investigate in a timely fashion any and all scurrying sounds I hear during the course of my day." Exactly like a dog does not go to sleep at night and say to herself, "I trust I found enough smelly things to roll in today." Unselfconscious responses to and participation in good for good's own sake. That's what God wants of us. And he doesn't necessarily use human power hierarchies, committees, creeds, systems of belief, doctrine, rules, and liturgy to do it. He needs our hearts, given to him personally, one person at a time, alone. Not brainwashing, not vows and communities of sin management. I'm about to make myself breakfast, because I got hungry. I try to approach God like that. I look to see if I'm hungry for prayer and reading the Bible and so on. See if God has built that into me. And what I find is that he did. So I try to never fake that desire. Try to never make it mainly about work or duty. Of course, sometimes I have to make sure I have some time set aside to read the Bible, and then I have to try reading it to see if I can get into it. But if I can't, I don't panic. I just wait and try again another time. And if I can, I don't inform the internet. Like today. I will see if I can get into the Bible. And if I can or can't, you'll never know. I see no good in my telling you stuff like that. It's private. That's me trying to grow out of being a Pharisee, because Pharisees didn't live like that. Step one, when something isn't working, is to stop doing that something. But why did Jesus come down so hard on people who'd done nothing worse than live a life that could be publicly seen to be mainly about ritualistic, habitual religious observance? Why no kind words? Why no gentle redirection? Why not one parable about the good Pharisee? Why the public denouncements, tarring them all with the one broad brush? Why dismiss them all with generalizations? I think God wanted people to accept a Jesus who'd come to announce that pretty much everybody had been getting God and religion all wrong. And I think that desire, that message, was and is directly threatened by what the Bible calls the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod, trying to live a Christian-seeming lifestyle so you'll look Christian to people, performing in the play that you have instead of a life, for an ever-changing audience made up of people who certainly never paid for tickets to anything. Some people have musicals, others are more avant-garde. killing with rocks and angrily hurled Bible verses anyone who stands in the way of your lead role in that play or is talking during your performance. If you've got that puffing up, pride-swelling, shame-based religious yeast fermenting and rotting away in the darkness, you can't let the light of Jesus shine in or you'll lose all that and need to be someone else. You've got to keep relying on self-control and what things look like rather than what they are if you want to keep growing all that all-too-human-reeking stuff. You're a candy shell on a dung-flavored M&M, to use some modernized Bible-esque imagery. But maintaining that candy shell will seem sensible to you. Essential. If my candy shell ever cracked, man, would I stink. But maintaining that candy shell will seem sensible to you. Essential. Like it's the only real option, with Jesus not being seen as a viable one, certainly. And it won't seem like a viable option for someone to get real. It will seem like the most irresponsible form of folly. It won't seem sensible at all. Because Jesus wasn't well received by sensible people. They were always concerned about things he or his disciples did. In fact, the whole Bible is full of stories about sensible people who don't have a clue, who have missed the point, who have concerns, whom God has little to do with in his ongoing work. The priest Eli, sensibly expressing his concern to the weeping, babbling, praying Hannah, future mother of the prophet Samuel, anointer of King David, that maybe she was drunk and shouldn't be at the temple praying to conceive a child. David's older brother Eliab, sensibly expressing his concern over what looked to him like a brash teenager who just wanted attention, hanging around offering to go fight Goliath and shouldn't be doing that. King David's wife Michal, sensibly expressing embarrassment and concern about his subjects seeing David's undignified, unkingly dancing before the Lord in jubilant worship and thinking he shouldn't be doing that. Job's comforting friends, sensibly assuming that they knew what was going on between Job and God, and it just had to involve Job being secretly sinful, and so he should repent. Judas Iscariot, sensibly expressing concern over Mary wasting expensive ointment by pouring it on Jesus to honor him, rather than selling it and giving money to the poor, because she should have done that instead. The prodigal son's elder brother, sensibly expressing his concern that prodigal behavior shouldn't be rewarded by celebrating his homecoming. Jesus' brother, sensibly warning him he shouldn't go into Jerusalem to fight with Pharisees, or he might end up dead. People sensibly expressing concern to Jesus over how impious it looked for his disciples to be picking grain to eat when they were hungry on the Sabbath, so they shouldn't do that. People sensibly asking whether it was the blind man or his parents who had done something they shouldn't, as he was clearly blind. People sensibly expressing concern about Jesus healing people on the Sabbath, because you shouldn't do that. People sensibly expressing concern over Jewish Christians eating with Gentile Christians, because Peter shouldn't do that. People sensibly expressing concern that Gentile Christians weren't being required to get circumcised sans anesthesia, because clearly they should be made to do that. People sensibly expressing concern over Christians possibly buying meat that might have been part of a pagan ritual before being sold afterward, because you shouldn't do that. It goes on and on. Sensible voices sensibly expressing an ever-growing list of concerns over how things looked, over the appearance of propriety, over purely imagined harm or entirely made-up disaster scenarios. Needing to standardize, control, and clear everything in advance with power people. Talking about should and shouldn't instead of is. Adjusting, correcting, and controlling rather than loving, tolerating, connecting, and helping. Making things worse in the name of keeping things from getting worse. Not doing anything good, but disrupting good by claiming to speak for good and interfering with someone who's doing the real deal. Doing nothing but being careful for and about everything. Being concerned only with expressing concerns. Some of us grew up drowning in the concerns of sensible people.